What the EFL? It's the Football League podcast that's never broken any financial rules. Coming up this week, Colchester in bloom as we speak to Hughes Boss, Claret's Kane Canaries and the big one in the Championship, Borough strike up the ban for Tuba, Sheffield Wednesday beat Plymouth Saturday, their scouting reports, and a League Two player gets savaged by admin in our Tweet of the Week. Powered by Quinbet, this is What the EFL. Hello again. Welcome along, listener, to our once a week chat about all things Football League. It's me, Matt Davis Adams, joined today by Adrian Clark.
Hello.
And Sam Parkin's back with us too.
Hello, Matt.
Hello, guys. Mentioned that we are partnered with Quinbet. How good is this? The guys at Quinbet have enhanced their UK welcome offer where you can now get a free bet worth up to £35. It's for new customers that sign up only. You can check out the full terms and conditions at quinbet.com/promotions or use the link provided in the description of this pod. It's 18 plus, and remember, always gamble responsibly. All right, we're going to kick off today with our weekend review. Only one place we could start, really. It's all been going swimmingly away from home for David Wagner since he took charge at Norwich. But as Dean Smith knows, life at Carrow Road can be tricky. That was certainly the case on Saturday. The Canaries had their wings clipped by Company's classy Clarets as Burnley left East Anglia with 3 points and 3 goals. Adrian, we've spent weeks and months talking about how impressive Burnley are, particularly attacking-wise, so you don't want to be gifting them goals in the way that Norwich did in this game.
You do not, no. Burnley have scored the first goal in 21 of 29 games. So they're used to getting their noses in front, but they normally have to work a little bit harder for it. Could have been one up inside a minute when Kenny McLean fell over basically and allowed them a good opportunity. It was Nathan Teller, but it didn't take them long. And it was just such a bad pass, wasn't it, from Tim Krul? I do not know really what he was looking at there, what he's seen. And Zaruri is one of the most informed players in the division, isn't he? I don't think too many of us had heard of Zaruri a year ago, maybe not even 6 months ago, but he looks Premier League level, doesn't he? I have to say, as do most of this team. Comprehensive is the way to describe this win. I mean, Norwich had been in good nick, or certainly better nick, under David Wagner, those big away wins, but outplayed by a Burnley side that continue to rotate, don't they? I mean, no Burnley starting 11 really looks the same week to week, yet they keep churning out outstanding results. I think Vincent Kompany has absolutely nailed the art of rotation. I've never been a huge fan of rotation, but if you can get it right and give the right players breathers at the right time, then it can be such a weapon, I think, for you. And yeah, they're coming into the back end of the season, Burnley, with most of their players fit, injury-free, and in the form of their lives. It is very, very impressive.
Sam, there's 23 points between these two teams now. I don't think many of us would have predicted that at the start of the season. Certainly not in the way that it is.
No, I'd have predicted Norwich to be higher, yeah. I would think. I think we went into the season thinking that they were going to be an unknown quantity, Burnley. I think the first performance, the opening night at Huddersfield, showed us that there was going to be something to really enjoy about the way Vincent Kompany was going to manage, I think, first and foremost. And the way that he's got them playing this beautiful football so quickly, it's taken everyone by surprise. And yeah, they had, I think, 4 big players missing for them at the weekend. So to have some fringe players come in and still win so comfortably says so much about how were they going. And Vincent Kompany was quick to point to the strong defence afterwards and that the goals have been a little bit in short supply. And that was the big question mark for me with that youthful backline and youthful goalkeepers. Could they go through this season without getting bullied, especially away from home? And they've been able to pour cold water on that sentiment. They've been brilliant. A couple of early season wobbles and then just outstanding, brilliant forward players. And Norwich were no match for them.
I think that Vincent Kompany has been the coach of the season in terms of the way that he's just transformed Burnley's tactical approach. For anyone that hasn't seen them in the Championship yet, they are the complete opposite of Burnley from the Premier League. It is remarkable. But Vincent Kompany is also the best recruiter of the season. I mean, the players that he's brought in for, okay, not modest fees, but he hasn't broken the bank. Players that are young, hungry, up and coming, They have been outstanding. Just look at the two centre-halves from the weekend. Jordan Bayer, for me, one of the most unsung players of the season, certainly one of the most underrated defenders. And then there was Hjalmar Ekdal, who came in for his debut and scored the goal and was virtually man of the match for Burnley. So his eye for a player is as good as his tactical approach.
Yeah, he'll do a good job in getting Manchester City out of League One the first attempt in a couple of years. I'm sure.
Could it happen? Could it happen, Matt? Seriously, could it happen? It's not going to happen, is it?
It's not going to happen, no, absolutely not. It'll take
happen
ages
to,
and then it'll go
to Swindon.
And it'll be turned over.
Hang on. Yeah. What do you mean happen to Swindon?
Happened to Swindon, got demoted two divisions. Did they not, Matt? Might need you to clarify that. Under Ozzy
many
RD
years
list.
Ago, yeah. I don't think they had quite as much money backing them as Manchester City do, and that might prove to be a decisive factor. Anyway, we'll see what happens with that. We might be talking about Manchester City on the show in years to come. We'll find out. We can talk about Swansea and Birmingham City, so incredible game between the two on Saturday. Birmingham scored twice in stoppage time, including a 97th minute winner to secure a 4-3 win. We ought to start with them, Birmingham. I feel like Swansea are actually the bigger story here, Sam, but given that Birmingham ended a run of five straight defeats, we ought to at least tip our caps to them first.
Yeah, a massive result for them. You could see at the end of the game what it meant after a torturous run. I mean, it seems to have been going on hell of a long time. I've spoken a few times on the podcast about that Reading victory, but that's been the one highlight of a really horrendous time for John Eustace and his players. And credit to him, half-time, no sentiment, couple of substitutions, changed the shape. Two experienced players, actually Gardner and Friend, were the ones that were taken off for Bakuna and Hannibal. We've spoken a lot about their 3-5-2, maybe not having the right players, particularly in the wide positions, to play that shape to great effect. Went to a 4-2-3-1 in the second half and were transformed through those substitutes, through Jukovic coming on later. Swansea tried to react. They brought on Harry Darling to try and stem the flow of the aerial bombardment, but to no effect. He was kind of involved at fault for maybe the two late Birmingham goals. And interestingly, Russell Martin, obviously there's a big narrative around him at the moment, but he'd made his substitutions at three different intervals. So he had to play with 10 at the end because Latif Bodier got injured and obviously they couldn't replace him. So he took responsibility for that, harsh as it was, because they were brilliant for 45 minutes, Swansea. They should have been 3-0 up, never a penalty. The Birmingham opening goal. Swansea played some majestic football. The Cullen goal, I think it was. That's prime Swansea, exactly what they want. Little intricate passing around the box, cut back, finish. But yeah, big story last week. Obviously, Russell Martin taking his whole backroom staff to the pre-match presser. And a window where the only incoming player, essentially, was Morgan Whittaker, who was already their player. So they desperately needed help in goal. And they desperately needed some help in the forward areas of the pitch, and they got neither. So I think that was a show of defiance. I think he was trying to create that siege mentality before the weekend. And they probably got it in the first half, and just circumstances kind of went against them, and a very determined opponent whose manager made some great decisions. But yeah, of all the teams in the Championship, there's a couple that jump out to me straight away. Blackburn being the other one, Swansea. They needed to reinforce in the window if they had any chance of making it into those playoffs.
Yeah, so if you missed this, listener, before the game against Birmingham, in his pre-match press conference, Russell Martin, as Sam said, brought his backroom staff in with him and basically let rip about the fact that the club hadn't been able to get any activity done in terms of incomings in January. He went through their recruitment process in detail and chucked a couple of bombs out there as to why it might not have happened. And Clarkie, this doesn't end well, does it? It ends one way, and that's with Russell Martin leaving Swansea at some point.
It does, but it ends with him leaving with his principles intact, his moral, you know, his stock pretty high. I think he's recognised as being an asset to Swansea. I think if you look around their squad and you look at Russell Martin himself, he is one of their best assets. I think he has the potential to manage at a higher level of his players. Not too many of them would look to be Premier League bound. So if he walked away, it wouldn't surprise me, because it's very difficult to manage with both hands tied behind your back. I don't think he was asking for too much. His goalkeeper is out for the season. He wants to replace him. I think it's totally understandable. Yeah, that squad needs reinforcing. So, Yeah, the lack of ambition is poor. And yeah, they're going to stagnate again, aren't they, Swans? They're not going to go up this season. I don't think that anyone believes that they're headed for the playoffs now. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with Russell Martin in his shoes. I would probably be eyeing up where I might end up next, if I'm being totally honest. Yeah, but by making that statement, you're alienating yourself from the big bosses, aren't you? And there will be a part in the ways, I'm sure of it.
But you would hope that the penny would have dropped with those big bosses, given that they've lost Steve Cooper and Graham Potter already, both of whom citing similar reasons for their exits. And now the Middlesbrough continue to tear up the championship under Michael Carrick. They swept aside Micmac's Blackpool at the Riverside Stadium. Borough third, albeit 10 points behind second, Sheffield, having played a game more. Clarkie, we're a couple of months removed from you bigging up Chubarak Pomtu. Lovely finishes from him here. Just wonder more broadly about Borough. It's not that good of a look for Chris Wilder, is it? That a rookie manager's come in with the same squad and basically got them flying up the league and looking like one of the best teams in it.
Yeah, it's a good point. I still don't think that Chris Wilder is a bad coach or a bad manager. I just think the fit wasn't right. He couldn't handle not being in charge of everything. And it's the same maybe as João Cancelo can't handle being a sub. It's like it's just a personality thing. He's a little bit more old school, needs that control. Michael Carrick was happy to work in these circumstances, concentrate on the coaching, and he is a good coach, isn't he? I think that much is clear for all to see. What I love about Michael Carrick so far is his ideas, his imagination. He's looked at Chubarak Pon and thought, you know what? I'm going to stick you in the hole and in behind the main striker, and you're going to make runs from deep, and you're going to have better opportunities to score. It's working like a dream. I mean, that chip goal was just glorious, wasn't it? One of the goals of the weekend for sure. Marcus Fors, always really being a striker, not a target man as such, someone that would just, you know, be neat and tidy, run around, good movement at the top end of the pitch. He's dynamite down the right at the moment. He's seen something in him to try him there. So yeah, his eye is excellent, and also his man management, because he's convincing these players that his fresh ideas will work and will help these players in the long run. So, yeah, what a start for Michael Carrick. He's up there with Carlos Corberan for appointment of the season, isn't he? It couldn't have gone much better. And you look at the squad is strong. The bench, Isaiah Jones was on it, Alex Mowat was on it, Dan Barlasser, the new signing, was on the bench. Look at the goal count. I always think teams that go up score goals freely. They don't rely solely on set plays and things like that. Well, open play goals for Middlesbrough, 36 of them, only Burnley have scored more. So Sheffield United, I don't think should book the end of season party just yet. I think that Middlesbrough are breathing down their necks. And I do think that if the Blades start slipping up, then Borough are best placed to catch them up, because Carrick has got them flying.
As for Blackpool, Sam, one shot on target and 24% possession, but this is not where their season's defined, is it? I'm just looking at their fixtures. Back-to-back home games against Huddersfield and Rotherham, and then away to Bad Vibes FC, aka Swansea. So that's where they need to start picking some points up.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll have highlighted those next two games, wouldn't they, in terms of getting a point of return. And that's how managers look at it, don't they? Look at it, blocks of games. And Mick McCarthy would have been optimistic in getting an upturn in performance, but maybe not points at the weekend at the Riverside. So, yeah, no surprise there. Said previously, I think there's enough firepower in that team. He'll be not judged, but he'll be expected to get them tighter and start keeping some clean sheets. And if they can do that, he's got a good chance of keeping in the division, I would say.
Yeah, they weren't terrible in this game. They didn't have much of the ball, less than 25% of it. But they did have chances. I think they hit the woodwork and they rattled Borough on a few occasions. So, yeah, sort of signs of promise. It didn't make me laugh. Their pass accuracy was under 50%, which I think for a professional football team is quite shocking. But I suppose it means that they went long and played the percentage game more often than not.
Let's go into League One. No doubt about the game of the weekend, the top two meeting at Hillsborough. Last week, both the boys confidently predicted a draw in this game. It was Sheffield Wednesday, though, who got the win against Plymouth Argyle thanks to a solitary strike from Callum Patterson early on. Moves Wednesday top above Argyle on goal difference, both 6 points clear of third placed Ipswich. What did you make of Wednesday in this game, Sam? Were they worth the win? The disallowed goal seemed to be the main talking point, which I thought was interesting given that they were already 1-0 up at the time.
Yeah, I think they just about edged it. You know, physically, very strong. I thought it was interesting that Stephen Schumacher went with this Ben Wayne in attack. I don't know if we've spoken about him. Signing from Wellington Phoenix in the window. He's a full New Zealand international. He scored for them, but he was their lone striker in the first half. Changed it at the break and brought on Cosgrove and Hardy. And I thought about what Clarkey said on the preview pod, you know, about those number 10s potentially holding the key and also going with, you know, not a physical front man as well. Maybe Stephen Schumacher thought they could just play around them at the edge of the box. A bit of intricate stuff could have hurt them. But actually, Aidan Flynn had a really dominant home debut for Sheffield Wednesday. Say debut, he's been there before, hasn't he? But you know what I mean. He was very good. They didn't really lay a glove on them, Plymouth. And in the first half, they obviously lost two very, very important players, the goalkeeper and Dan Scar, the middle of that the defence. So he had to change in the second half. They got a little bit more possession, but obviously Sheffield Wednesday had the better chances, had their nose in front by that point. Callum Patterson playing wide, right wing back, I think he was, which surprised a few, but him and Flint were really good performers. And as you said, there was the opportunity to extend that lead. Strange decision. And if the officials have taken their lead by looking at the big screen at Hillsborough, that doesn't sit particularly well with me. And the goalkeeper was never, ever getting to George Byers' strike, irrelevant of Lee Gregory's position. So just about the right result, but I don't think Plymouth will be deterred. And two good teams going at it, and it's going to take some finish to the season from Ipswich to claw back that gap now.
Now, Dean Holden continues to impress as Charlton boss. The Addicts up to 12th after they won at Exeter. 4 wins from the last 5 league games, Adrian. And in Rakitic, they got one of the best loan signings of the season, haven't they, in the EFL? 10 points off the playoffs. It's not too late for a push.
I don't know. I think there are too many good teams above them. In League One, they've got the squad for a playoff push, no doubt about it. But they're coming from quite a long way back, aren't they? They were treading water for too long potentially. But no, I like the squad. They have no issue scoring goals, do they? I was talking about goals earlier with Middlesbrough. Well, in terms of open play goals in League One, only Ipswich have scored more than Charlton. So going forward, they've got that power. They've got pace. They've got talented players and they will be a threat to anyone. But it's just, yeah, consistency's been the issue. Two good goals in this game. Did you see the goals? Really nice. I thought Rakitic's was tremendous, actually. The way he sort of came onto the ball, left-footed on the volley, made it look incredibly easy. And then the second one, Blackett-Taylor, you know, offers that pace in behind, gets beyond and again, makes it look pretty simple, really. So, yeah, when you've got those two guys out wide, either side of the main striker, you've got the ability to produce match-winning moments in a flash, haven't you? I think that those two players can frustrate the supporters. They don't always offer that much. They'll make mistakes, but they can carry the ball and make things happen. And I think that that makes a huge, huge difference, especially at League One level, where there's not always that much between some of the teams. So yeah, no, really, really impressive result for Charlton. And yeah, they can look upwards. But yeah, I suspect next season might be the promotion push rather than this one.
Yeah, next, doing all right for a newly promoted side of change manager, but home form a concern for them. No wins in front of their own supporters since November. In League Two, Stockport County moved into the playoff places courtesy of a 3-2 win against Tranmere at Edgeley Park. More than 10,000 packed in, a sellout crowd up there in the northwest witnessed the home side's first win in 4 attempts. Sam, Tranmere's defensive issues here twisting Mickey's melon, man.
Yeah, and funny that defensively they're getting caught out, because early part of the season, they were incredibly solid. I think they had 5 wins on the bounce, 5 clean sheets as well. Daniel Simeo is getting rave reviews. He's since gone off to Morecambe. And definitely Jordan Turnbull at fault, half at fault for one of the goals at the weekend. And Matthias Huelts in goal, he could have done better for 2 of them. Joe Murphy's the other option, 41 years young now on the bench. So he could be getting a recall given how bad they were defensively at the weekend. But Stockport, I talked them up early part of the season. They've had a little wobble or a blip. Can't remember what we decided on last week. But I had another look at the stats today. And fourth shots on target, second big chances created, third for expected goals, fifth lowest XG conceded. I think this is a good side. This is a physical, strong outfit, invariably a 3-5-2. And they've got some forward players in the main. Wootton, who's in really good form, scored back-to-back now. He was the best forward player on display at the weekend. Five attempts, hit the woodwork on a couple of occasions. And him and Madden are a good partnership. But I think the structure of the side, attacking outside centre-halves as well, has been a bit of a feature. Chris Hussey supplied the assist for the first goal. And I think they'll be in the shake-up, definitely, at the end of the season.
Yeah, looking good for Stockport. As for Colchester United, they took on Barrow this weekend, but don't take our word for it. We're going to hear from their manager. Matt Bloomfield joins us next. Matt, we're talking, what, hours still really after the game on Saturday. Now you've had a couple of days to reflect, given the timing of the equaliser and the fact you'd missed a pen. Are you satisfied with a point?
Yeah, most certainly so. I think I knew that Barrow was going to be a real tough opposition, given that their result in midweek at Carlisle. I know Pete Wild very well and respect him immensely. I knew that he'd have his boys fired up and ready to go. So it was never going to be an easy afternoon for us. They're a team that are going for the playoffs. Obviously had a really, really good season. So on reflection of the game over as a whole, I do believe that we were worthy of the point. Although it came very late, you know, we missed a couple of good chances, missed a penalty. So we have to be satisfied to show the character to get a late goal and find the equaliser.
Must be a big boost for you in the squad to have Kwesi Appiah back as well.
Oh, most certainly so. Yeah, Kwesi scored two goals in my first two league games back in October. And unfortunately, you know, a couple of little injuries have led to him spending a lot of time out of the team, out of the picture. So he's definitely got a goal in him as Kwesi. He's got a great personality, a real zest for football and zest for life. And I think he's been absolutely a big personality for us. Could be a big player for us in these next couple of months. We hope we'll have him on the pitch more often than not.
So come on then, Matt, tell us about life as a gaffer. It's not that long since you hung up your boots. You've gone straight in at Colchester United. Not an easy job to take. The club was struggling, or the team was struggling when you took over, but you're steadily climbing the table. What's the experience been like so far for you?
It's been amazing. It really, really has, Adrian. I've loved every minute of it. It's really tough. It's been really, really tough. I've learned so much about myself and about this football club, about the squad. I think I had a fairly good idea of what I wanted to imprint on the football club, and I hope that we've made small steps towards that. But you know, it's not, after not being out of the change room long, being a first team coach at Wickham, I knew it was going to be a big step, but it just felt it was the right opportunity for me at the right stage in my life and my career. And it really felt that when I went to the interview meeting, the chairman and the sporting director and a couple of members of the board, it felt like it was the right football club at the right time. Our values and vision aligned, and I'm really pleased that I took the opportunity like I did here. I knew that there was a big job on. I knew that there was a lot of work to do, but I also had total belief in myself and the staff I was hoping to bring that we could go and achieve it. I knew that as a football club, it's a club that deserves success. Robbie, the chairman's put a lot of money, a lot of hours, a lot of effort into this place. The training ground's fantastic. The ground is fantastic. You know, it's all there set for success. It just needed a little bit of luck along the way. And I hope that I could bring the energy and enthusiasm to do that.
Oh, sure you will. Just very quickly, what was the interview process like then? You know, what do you rock up in for an interview? What were the toughest questions? Like, what had you got prepped? I'm just interested. Obviously, it's a big moment for you going for that interview.
Yeah, it was huge. It was a really big moment. I tried to dress appropriately. I dressed up smart. I prepared a presentation. I'd already done my prep work in terms of Colchester as a football club. I mean, I grew up in Felixstowe, Suffolk, so I've known Colchester and the football club for many years. I'm a bit of a football nut, so I kind of know a lot of the squad, having played against them or been involved in games against them. I'd already watched three games previously of Colchester's recent games, just to get more of a background knowledge on the team and how they were performing at the time. I went with ideas of how I wanted to move the team forward, how I wanted to move the squad forward, how I felt a football club should be run from the head coach. my beliefs about how we, you know, treat each other, the culture and the environment I wanted to create. And I tried to present that in the best way I possibly could and present myself as well, because I believe that, you know, football is a game of people, and good connections can build successful football teams. And that's why I hope to try and get across. And I was really, really fortunate that they believed in me and had the faith to give me the job here, which I was, you know, I was and am still extremely, extremely grateful for this opportunity.
Matt, I know new managers always get asked this question. Well, they get asked, who have they taken inspiration from? What little bits from what manager? I'm going to be more precise than that. What have you taken from Gareth Ainsworth into your first managerial role? Is the culture something that you want to try and replicate that you had at Wickham at Colchester?
Yeah, I think that the culture and the environment that we lived our lives in at Wickham was something I absolutely loved. I still speak to so many of the players and the staff. There doesn't really seem to be a day goes by that I don't speak to someone associated with Wickham Wanderers from over the years, whether that be players that have left or staff or players that are still there, just because I think that we built connections, really deep bonds in terms of the way we went about our business. And that's one of the things that I've realised over many years in football. Those successful seasons are those ones that you share with like-minded people, people who are desperate for success, people who want to treat their environment and the culture around the building correctly. And that's the biggest learning I took from the last few years at Wickham Wanderers and from the gaffer, was that, you know, those connections and those people are absolutely everything to a football club. And I think that the people inside the building are the heart and the soul of it. And I wanted to try and use those experiences, not replicate. I'm not trying to copy anything. I need to be myself. I'm trying to be authentic at what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to live my life in this new job by my beliefs. But at the same time, I think we were extremely fortunate at Wickham from the gaffer downwards that we were aligned in our beliefs of how we wanted to go about our business. And certainly that could be the bedrock for a successful football club. And I believe that we have the basis here. There's so many good people already here, Sam, in terms of the directors, the chairman, people in the academy office, some really good lads in the change room. And I think that there was the basis of a really successful football club. I just really wanted to have the opportunity. I'm really pleased that I can take a lot of those learnings from a long career in football and hopefully use them here at Colchester.
I mean, looking at your squad now as well, incredibly strong in comparison to when you took the job, the work you did in the window, Matt. You must be incredibly pleased. Has that altered your ambitions for what you can achieve for the rest of the season? Because you're not a team that should be down in the lower reaches of the division.
No, I think, number one, mate, I'm really, really pleased with the work. I'm really fortunate that the chairman's backed the recruitment in the January transfer window. I thank the chairman and the board for their backing in terms of what we wanted to do. Tom Hopper, Matt Jay, Connor Hall, Fika Kelleher, Arthur Reid, Connor Wood. These are really, really good lads, really, really good people. I met them all in person or minimum on Zoom before they signed. Character and profile and personality was something I was really, really big on and really put at the forefront of our recruitment process. Obviously, these lads are good players as well and had good careers. So we feel that we're a better squad coming out of the January window than going into it. But one thing I think we need to be mindful of the fact is that we're still in transition, Sam. Like, these lads have only been in the building a couple of weeks and we shouldn't look to run before we can walk. Of course, we want to be as ambitious as we possibly can between now and the end of the season. We set high expectations of ourselves on a daily basis, mate. That's the only way you can improve. But at the same time, we've got to integrate these lads into the team. Usually when you make a whole host of signings, you've got a 6-week pre-season to build into it. So we're really mindful of the fact that we don't have that, but we're certainly not being pessimistic. We want to be optimistic as we can be, and we've signed some good players and we want to get them on the pitch as often as we can and create a winning culture between now and the end of the season to move towards next season.
Yeah, seems like you're heading in the right direction, no doubt about that. I remember speaking to Paul Fairclough years ago when he was Barnet manager, and he was telling me about like things that he didn't expect to have to do when he was manager of a football league club. He was talking about going around the training pitch and clearing up the dog poo before a session and stuff like that. Is there anything that you're having to do that you think, hang on, no one told me I'd have to do this if I was an actual football manager? What surprised you?
No, I'll be honest with you. Having lived the life at Wickham for as long as I did, one thing it has given to me is a humility in terms of what you can expect to do being involved in a professional football club. We lived our lives there on a shoestring budget for many, many years. So there's not been anything that surprised me yet. I came in with my eyes wide open. I really, really did. I wanted to embrace every experience that I came across. There's obviously been some testing times. You know, you lose games and you think about your decisions. You think about things that have gone against you in games, and you really kind of have to look in the mirror so often. Every day you have to look in the mirror and question whether you've done the right thing and are we moving ourselves forward. But in terms of jobs that have come my way, there's been nothing that surprised me because I look to embrace every opportunity I possibly can. So it's just an exciting time for me in terms of this opportunity, Adrian. It really, really is. And to see these lessons that I'm learning along the way, not only just about the football club, but about myself. And I'm sure there'll be plenty more incoming.
I know, Matt, I want to finish with some hard-hitting questions, but just quickly, you're in your office now at Colchester United. Matt, what was the transfer window like? I've got visions of you and your staff sat there, biscuits, late into the night, Sky Sports News on, not very glamorous. Is that the case?
No, I was actually at home on deadline.
Business all done,
night.
All done.
Yeah, we've been planning for months, Sam. Obviously, we had sort of 5 walkthrough in the first week. We did a lot of our work before the window, a lot of conversations, a lot of planning, a lot of watching footage. And to come transfer window, we're really pleased with the business we did early on. Of course, we had to make a couple later in the window in terms of covering defenders and a goalkeeper. But come deadline day, we weren't looking to do any business unless it was incoming from outside. So we were comfortable with what we'd done and we weren't chasing anything at that point. So for me, it was a fairly comfortable last day. I packed up the office normal time at 6:30 and headed home for see my girls before they went to bed. Phone was on, obviously, but there was no last minute scrambling going on.
Nice. I'm sure that'll come at some point in your managerial career. Now, Matt, we really appreciate your time today. But as Sam says, I am going to finish, as we always do, with a hard-hitting question to really put you on the spot. This one's a little awkward, to be honest. You and I have very similar degrees. I've been on your LinkedIn page this morning. Mine's in broadcast journalism. Yours is in sports writing and broadcasting. But you got a better mark than I did. So I just wondered if you could give me some tips on how I can be a better broadcast journalist. You know, maybe you've been thinking of the interviews, as the interview's been going on, about all the stuff I've been doing wrong. Help me be more Matt Bloomfield and less Matt Davis Adams.
I'll be honest, mate, I think I've got enough on my plate at the moment to try and do my job as well as I possibly can without trying to pretend I can do other people's as well. So guys, you know, I've spoken to Sam before. I really enjoy your podcast. I'm immersed in anything football, and especially if I can get some information about other clubs in our league or anything that's going on in the FL. So I think you do a great job. I really enjoy listening, and I'm just thankful that you've invited me on. So thanks for having me this afternoon.
All right, you are automatically our favourite ever guest that we've had on, just for that answer.
Go on, Matt, use.
We really appreciate your time today, Matt. All the best for the rest
of
the season.
Take care, guys. Yeah, thanks for having me on. Take care. Speak soon.
Oh, man.
Many thanks to Matt for taking time out of his busy schedule to have a chat with us. Next today is the return of Scouting Reports. Right then, two players who've been doing bits, as somebody younger than me might say, in the EFL that the chaps would like to bring to your attention. Adrian, you've gone for David McGoldrick. Good lad in one sense, in that he was born in Nottingham and in his ex-forest, but he's currently down the A52 with the other mob, and he's doing pretty well. Third hat-trick of the season this weekend.
Yes, incredible. He's had a 20-year career, David McGoldrick. Never had a hat-trick. Scored lots and lots of goals. Not that prolific, I guess, but never had a hat trick until this season. And now he's got 3: Forest Green Rovers, Bristol Rovers, and Morecambe, the victims, and really, really good hat tricks as well. I've looked at his finishes. I think the way that he finds space inside the box, he stays in space as the play's building up, is really, really clever. And he's a very astute finisher with either foot. Obviously his right foot's stronger than his left, but he can produce them. And he's also got a lovely little touch and turn in his locker. He can control it with his back to a defender, pivot, and then spank one in the bottom corner. He is a real talent. I would go as far as to say that David McGoldrick's touch and awareness are actually exceptional at League One level. I don't know if there's that many other players that can touch him in terms of his ability in and around the box, which begs the question, what's he doing in League One? But I think you get to that stage in your career. I never got there, unfortunately, because I had such a short career. But where you get in your mid-30s, probably your kids are at school, and you're like, I could go to a championship club at the other end of the country, or I could find a good League One club and kind of go home. You know, he's from the Nottingham area. And I think that that has probably helped him as well. He feels very settled in that particular part of the country, working for Warren. And he's surrounded by good players. Well, I mean, when you're a forward, at number 10 or striker, and you've got Mendes, Lang and Barkhuizen and Knight, Dobbin, Bird, all having great seasons, the ammunition is going to come, isn't it? So, I just think it's the right time to shine a light on David McGoldrick. Well done, Paul Warren, I think, for sort of bringing the best out of him. And one other thing to say about that is that Warren is aware that he's 35 and he won't make him play 90 every week, and he will give him the odd breather, and he's managing his minutes very, very well at the moment. So, yeah, I mean, 14 goals in all competitions, 12 in the league. He's not had that many starts, to be perfectly honest, McGoldrick, but he's been very, very prolific. So, yeah, wonderful season for him. And if he keeps it up, then Derby could get into that picture, couldn't they, where Ipswich and Plymouth and Sheffield Wednesday are. They're not a million miles away. If he maintains this level, Derby could go up this season, which would be an amazing story, given that they were on their knees a year ago.
Yeah, let's hope not. As many goals in the league this season as he's got in the previous three combined. So that's one end of the age and experience spectrum, 35-year-old David McGoldrick. Sam, you're going to the other end, also in League One and near the top of it too, on loan from Manchester United at Bolton as of last month. Shola Shuratire, what do you like about him?
Well, Clarkie had 18 years to talk about there. I've got three games and Clarkie's got a train to catch. Or I thought he did. Blimey. this kid, he's played for Manchester United in Europe. I think he broke a Norman Whiteside record, being the youngest previously. He's played in the PL, came on for Rashford, I think, in a game. He's a dribbler, which is something that Bolton haven't had this season in the number 10 position. Afellay obviously was allowed to leave for Germany, I think, but obviously more of a wide player. So this has been a gap in Ian Everett's squad, which he's filled now with this young man. He's been unfortunate. First game was Forest Green when someone got sent off. Dion Charles, wasn't it, wrongly? So they played with 10 for like 70 minutes. Then he got injured at Charlton after an hour. And then they played against Cheltenham at the weekend, which was, I think, a very, very physical game, which they did well to win 1-0. But it was a tough game for him. But in that, showed a really good work ethic. And it was the hour against Charlton that I wanted to talk about, really, where similarly, I liked his tenacity without the ball. There was a moment in the first half when he won the ball. I think it was Matt Penny and Ness, the young lad who had a little bit of a breakdown in communication. He nicked the ball. His timing of his pass into Dion Charles to get his strike away was excellent. And it was his awareness to me that stood out throughout the piece. Made a number of chances for Charles, had a couple of shots himself in the second half. And I think he could be a really important player for Ian Everett for the rest of the season. They've had three wins on the bounce since he's been in the side. So he's definitely struck the right chord, I think, with the supporters and the manager. He's kept his place. And, you know, having seen him in the PL2 and watched back a number of highlights, he can finish, he can go past people. He's a top player, as you would expect from an academy. But that game understanding, the awareness, variety of positions that he's played already as well. He's played in the two, played at a 10 in the weekend behind Charles and Adebayo. So he's got options now in those front positions. And I think he looks to be an excellent pickup.
Yeah, like you, I saw a bit of him in PL2 and he'll always seem pretty lively there. So that's Shola Shuratire and David McGoldrick, the subjects of this week's scouting reports. Right, that'll just about do us for today, but we do have a tweet of the week. Actually, we've got two tweets of the week for you. Firstly, thanks to listener Jacek, who brought to our attention the bilingual effort of Leicester keeper Jakub Stolarczyk, who made his debut on loan for Hartlepool at the weekend. He was moved to tweet about it. What a way to make my league debut for at official HUFC. Blue circle emoji, white circle emoji, clean sheet and 3 points, gloves emoji. Massive thanks to the travelling fans. Support was unbelievable, flames emoji. Let's take it on to the next one. Hashtag HUFC, hashtag JS41. All absolutely textbook stuff. But then he puts it in Polish underneath as well. And what I really liked about that, Sam, was that he's kept the emojis the same, albeit he's put UTP at the end instead of hashtag JS41. But do you get more points in your book for tweeting in two languages in one go?
You're a man of simple emoji pleasure, aren't you, Matt? yeah, of course. And I don't actually mind the appreciation of the supporters here, because I've seen the goal and I've seen the limbs. I used to call it bundles back in my day, and it was pretty ferocious from the Hartlepool supporters. So yeah, I want to see him improve on that and not be as obvious moving forward and be, you know, critical when he's getting booed and called useless in the weeks ahead. But on Saturday's evidence, supporters were certainly at it. He was at it. Bilingual. It's an 8, isn't it?
Yeah. It's impressive. I wasn't even aware of the gloves emoji. It's brought it to my attention. Yeah, something I might steal at some point. I don't know how much of a fan I am of making up my own hashtag, you know, JS41.
That's a good point, mate. Yeah.
A little bit of big time.
But he's not the first one to do it. Gabriel Zakawani, remember him? Defender who knocked around the lower leagues. He used to have hashtag every day I'm tackling, which always used to grind my gears. Kurt Zouma, hashtag Lazumonts, whatever that means on the end of his tweets. It's a thing, I'm afraid.
Yeah, we've just got to accept it, haven't we? But yeah, no, the two languages in one tweet, and he's kept it within the word count. That's phenomenal, really.
But anyway, that is a mere warm-up for the real tweet of the week, which is absolutely sensational stuff. Harry Pell and Leighton Orient have beef. It all started when Orient tweeted out a graphic comparing the Wimbledon midfielder with their own George Moncur ahead of them going toe-to-toe on Saturday. Pell didn't like this, and he quote tweeted it saying, "If you're putting stats up, .. at least make sure they're correct," fuming emoji, and then a kind of shrugging emoji. So, of course, what's going to happen? George Moncur scores the winning goal. Leighton Orient tweet, "Hi, at Harry Pell 7. Sorry about getting those stats wrong." Palm to the face emoji. "To make it up to you, we ran the data on today's game. Let us know when you finish proofreading. Hashtag LOFC. Hashtag One Orient." And of course, the graphic shows that Moncur has beaten Pell in pretty much every achievable metric, from FOP mob rating to goals. Oh, they've even put fell over and subbed off in there as well. Fell over 4 times, subbed off once. It's a fine line, Clarkie. We speak about this a lot, about admin going a little too far. But I think this is absolutely perfect.
I think it wins, doesn't it? It's tweet of the week. It's tweet of the month. I don't know. It's a contender for tweet of the season. I'm all over it. The effort that's gone into it to obviously rebuild a graphic and to include the fell over stat. Moncur fell over no times. He fell over 4, subbed off. I mean, it's just, it is pretty funny, I've got to say. So, I'm assuming young Harry didn't have a little bite. I'm assuming he just let this one go, did he?
Certainly haven't seen anything as of yet. I noticed that they've played both games between one another, so there's no danger of him getting the comeback in the reverse fixture. He indeed has not tweeted since that very moment.
What time did it go, the Leighton Orient follow-up tweet? Because I'm just thinking they surely would have waited until the Wimbledon coach had departed, because Harry Pell is quite a big fella.
6:12,
I would suggest.
6:12 p.m. So you're bang on. The coach would be just up the motorway.
You know what? That's brave. Listen, I think the error is in going in the first place, because they're actually paying him a bit of a compliment, highlighting his battle with George Moncur. He's pretty much saying he's a threat. You know, how's it going to go today? And they've obviously highlighted him. So even if there was something a little bit off, you know, it wouldn't have been my style to go in. But yeah, he's a big physical boy, isn't he? And he's life and soul at Wimbledon dressing room. So I would have suggested sending that follow-up one a little bit later.
Would have been amusing to be in the Wimbledon dressing room on Monday morning, I think, when they all came in for training, to see just how much stick that he got. Never mind, Harry. Maybe the move to Orient is not on the cards in the near future, but I'm sure you can get your own back one way or another one day in the near future. That's going to just about do us for today. Before we go, though, Clarkie, tell everybody about our various social media channels.
Yeah, we're huge on social media right now. I've got to say, I think we are reaching a wider audience. We're getting quite a few new listeners, which is brilliant. So please do tell your friends. Yeah, it's Instagram, we're at WhatTheEFL, and on TikTok, it's surprise, surprise, at WhatTheEFL. We're going to put clips up of the show each week, sort of a best bits bit. And if you want to see us talking, as well as just listening to us, it's the place to be.
At EFL Watler on Twitter. We're all on Twitter as well. You can find us there. Give us a rating if your podcast platform of choice offers such a thing. Please, we would really appreciate it. It helps us find new listeners and them to find us too. Also, before we go, another reminder of that offer from our friends at Quinbet. They've enhanced their UK welcome offer where you can now get a free bet worth up to £35. It's for new customers that sign up only. You can check out full terms and conditions at quinbet.com/promotions or use the link provided in the description of this pod. It's 18 plus, and remember, always gamble responsibly. That's going to do it for this edition of What the EFL Then. Again, we are indebted to Matt Bloomfield for giving us his time to chat about life at Colchester. Thanks to Adrian and to Sam too. We'll catch up with you again next week. Bye for now.